From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. The gaming world can be a hostile place for women.
It actually reinforces this cultural myth that women are sexual objects and sexual playthings for male amusement, and we're not.
We're saving them. They're damsels in distress. I'm saving the princess. Am I supposed to let the princess die? Is that what you want? That's kind of harsh. That's kind of hostile.
Well, maybe the princess shouldn't be a damsel, and she could save herself.
Today, we meet the women behind a game where the brave, spunky female lead rescues a prince in distress. But first, we talked in the break room last week about gun control. In the wake of the horrific school shooting in Parkland, Florida, some are calling for restricted access to assault weapons. Here's Natalie Pavelski during that conversation.
That's just a start, though. I mean, the AR-15, it's not hyperbole, Greg. This is the civilian version of a military weapon designed specifically to kill as many people as possible. Nobody needs that.
And here are your first thoughts.
This is John Alexander. This morning I was listening to the radio show when everybody's talking about weapons, getting rid of assault weapons, getting rid of all this stuff. And to me, you're not looking at the real cause, which to me is the violence on television, the violence on video games. If you want to stop this, stop violent television programs, stop violent video games. And that will be cutting a lot of the problems down. Thank you.
We looked into it, John, and here's what we found. There is no link between violent movies and video games and actual violence. Some studies even show that gaming can decrease violence among young kids. But the many, many studies and surveys show either no relationship between violent behavior and video gaming or an insignificant link. We also got an email from Ryan that said, quote, "Our right to bear arms is not some preservation of our right to hunt. It is an expressed right to institutionalize revolution in our government's system. Much like our Constitution was devised to constrain our government, our right to bear arms is an additional constraint," end quote. We're also still getting responses to our show about Confederate monuments. Janaid writes that he takes foreign visitors to Stone Mountain regularly and, quote, "It has never occurred to me or them that having these beautiful statues is in any way a declaration of agreement with their politics. The flag was a different issue, but with art that pays some tribute to fallen leaders of a repudiated era, we should not have so much sensitivity," end quote. We always love to get your thoughts, so call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter and Facebook, or you can email us, of course, and we might feature your comments on the show. A film about a Georgia school is up for an Oscar. DeKalb Elementary is nominated in the live-action short category. It's based on a 2013 school shooting in Decatur. Thankfully, no one was killed in that incident because of a school employee named Antoinette Tuff. She talked the gunman down.
Okay, police, what's addressing your emergency?
Yes, ma'am. I'm on 2nd Avenue in the school, and the gentleman said, tell them to hold down. The police officers are coming, and he said he's going to start shooting, so tell them to back off.
Okay, one moment.
Do not let anybody in the building, including the police. Do not let anybody in the building, including the police.
The short film DeKalb Elementary brings that 911 call to life.
Call 911. Tell them to hold the police back. They come in, I'm gonna start shooting.
I'm on 2nd Avenue in the elementary school. There's a gentleman here with a gun, and he said, tell the police to back off or he's gonna start shooting.
I'm in the front office. Ooh, he just went outside and started shooting.
Reed Van Dyke is the writer and director of DeKalb Elementary. I spoke to him recently. Remind us briefly of the story of what happened with this shooter and this employee.
Yeah, I'm just remembering listening to that clip, how amazing it is that she said these things. So essentially, the film is inspired by this 911 call that made national news back in 2013. And Antoinette Tuff was in the front office filling in for the receptionist at the front office at the elementary school when Michael Hill walked in with an AK-47. And, you know, he took her hostage, or sort of asked her to become a conduit to the police. And, you know, then what transpired between them is what the film is.
So let's hear actually a clip as she begins to try to reach out to him. This is, again, the shooter talking with that school employee who's being held at gunpoint.
I can help. You want me to try? Maybe I can talk to him and help you somehow.
It don't matter. I'm going to go away for a long time.
if I talk to them, maybe we can work something out where you won't have to go away with them for a long time.
You know, man, I'm already on probation.
But that doesn't matter. I could tell them that you haven't harmed me or tried to do anything with me.
I shot the police.
But that doesn't matter. You didn't hit anybody.
You don't know that.
So that perpetrator that in real life was a 20-year-old, Michael Brandon Hill. He did go away for a long time. He was sentenced to 2 decades in prison. Did you need to speak to Antoinette Tough or Michael Hill before you got started on the film?
I didn't speak to them directly before I got started. In part, you know, I made this film as a student, and you know, was really moved by her words and actions, and wasn't actually sure how the film would turn out. And so I, you know, compiled all kinds of research. Obviously, the call, there were police reports and court documents and video camera footage from the actual school office. And I, you know, sort of compiled that research and then began my adaptation process. I've since, you know, reached out to Antoinette and I've written a letter to Michael.
You know, this is one of those films that's a little bit like say the classic 12 Angry Men or something, right? Like there's no car chases. It mostly takes place in one room with a limited number of characters. How do you handle that kind of challenge? You know, in order to keep people interested, sometimes people try a lot of CGI and special effects and scene changes. This doesn't have that.
Well, it's so funny you mentioned 12 Angry Men, actually, because that was a reference point for me when I was writing the script and trying to convince myself that it would actually work.
You're kidding.
I actually watched that film a number of times and used it as a reference in talking to other people about the film because, of course, you know, there's an impulse to, as you say, to sort of crank up the tension and cross-cut between what's going on outside and inside. The thing I kept coming back to was my experience of this story was just purely auditory. And I didn't have any visuals. The only thing I had were Antoinette's voice, Michael's voice, and the voice of that dispatcher.
Hello, ma'am? Okay. He said to tell them to back off. He doesn't want the kids. He wants the police. So back off. And what else, sir? He said he don't care if he dies. He don't have nothing to live for. And he said he's not mentally stable.
Okay, stay on the line with me, okay? Put the phone down if you have to, but don't put it on hold so I can't hear.
Okay.
That actually created, obviously, an identification with the people inside that room and a question as to what was going on outside of the room. And I felt that was dramatic enough and, you know, and the focus is really between what transpires between Antoinette and Michael and not actually what's happening with the cops.
How closely did you stick to what was really said in that office?
As closely as I possibly could. I mean, my first draft of the script was just the transcript in a Word document. And then it became a process of figuring out, of course, how to start the film, end it, give it some sort of shape. But the goal was always, you know, to not make anything dramatic that wasn't true or true to what happened or even true to the flow of what happened between them, and also not to sensationalize it or make any sort of movie moment that just was not the truth of what happened.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Reed Van Dyke. He's the writer and director of the short film DeKalb Elementary that has been nominated for an Oscar. The film is based on an actual school shooting that happened in 2013 at the Ronald McNair Discovery Learning Academy in Decatur. And I wonder, Reed, how quickly you decided you wanted to turn that, what was originally a news report, into a film.
It took a little while. I mean, I stumbled on the call accidentally. I hadn't heard about the story back when it happened in 2013. I was doing research for another script I was writing about a mass shooting incident. And for that script, I just needed to know how a 911 dispatcher answers the phone. Like, what's the protocol? What do they say? And I Googled 911 call, and that happened to be the call that popped up.
Oh, wow.
And so I listened to it, and I couldn't stop. I mean, I kept pausing it because I would become overwhelmed with feeling for both of these people and just this extraordinary circumstance and obviously, you know, her remarkable compassion. And so, I mean, I kept thinking about her and I kept thinking about him and for probably a couple weeks. And then eventually I thought, gosh, maybe I could try to turn this into a short. I was a student at UCLA at the time and I had to make a short film for my next project. And I thought, well, maybe I could try to do justice to this story.
What do you think the story says that still resonates now? I mean, what as you, are you as a filmmaker trying to point out about this real-life situation?
One of the things I've tried to do is to construct the story in such a way that it's not messaging you or preaching to you, but I mean, I continue to respond, you know, even listening to Antoinette. I listened to the call briefly yesterday, and I was overwhelmed by her orientation
still.
It's overwhelming, her orientation toward people in general, toward him, you know, to look at somebody who would have very understandably inspired fear. And she, you know, she saw a person who was suffering and who needed help.
It's going to be all right, sweet. I just want you to know that I love you, though, okay? And I'm proud of you. That's a good thing that you've just given up, and don't worry about it. We all go through something in life. No, you don't want that. You're going to be okay. I thought the same thing. You know, I tried to commit suicide last year after my husband left me. But look at me now. I'm still working, and everything is okay.
I wonder if all this work that you've done on this film, you know, a sad fact of modern day America at this point is that there are new headlines about shootings and often school shootings. And I wonder how your work on this film has colored your perception of those headlines when they occur.
I think it's helped me perhaps not to become desensitized to them. It's very hard. There are stories now, you know, that I'm reading about how we've all sort of turned away from these stories. They recur so frequently that we're almost, desensitized. And, you know, I became very interested in this subject matter. Just this film is one way in which I sort of worked out my own interest in the subject and this phenomenon of mass shootings in the country. But I suppose it helps me to continue to take an interest in this distinctly American phenomenon.
Would you make another short film? I mean, this one was made because it was an assignment for school. But do you like the format?
I do. I mean, I've certainly gotten, I think many of us, we internalize and absorb the sort of structure of a feature-length film. But now having been working at shorts for the past, you know, 5-10 years, and I do feel more comfortable with this form. This film was not my thesis film at school, so I actually have one more short that I just finished in December. That will hopefully show up at some festivals this year or next.
And I wonder what it's like for you now to watch it, even after all this time. Do you still feel like tinkering with it?
One is always, many writer-director friends, we're all our own worst critics. And so, there's always things you'd want to do. But it's also nice to enjoy it with an audience who's experiencing it for the first time because you can get to see it through their eyes.
Reed Van Dyke is the writer and director of the Oscar-nominated short film DeKalb Elementary. The film's based on an actual event in Georgia. We'll be watching the Academy Awards this Sunday, so good luck.
Thanks, Celeste.
Just ahead, I talk with the first female puppeteer from Sesame Street. But first, bringing more women to the video gaming world. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Video games are a multi-billion dollar worldwide industry, and about half of the people who play games are women. But women make up only 14% of those who work in the game industry, and most games are marketed to men. A common theme in many games is also a man rushing off to save a woman in peril. A new Atlanta-based game is looking to flip that script. Prince Napped follows a strong female character on a quest to save a kidnapped Prince. The game's produced by a mostly female team at Kerchunk Games in Norcross. Joining me now is Molly Proffitt, Chief Executive Officer for Kerchunk, and Leah Knighton, Chief Creative Officer. Hi to both of you.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
And also via Skype, we have Kate Edwards, formerly Executive Director of the International Game Developers Association, now runs her own company called Geography. Hi, Kate.
Hey. Hi there.
Hi. So, you know, Molly, a really common I guess, argument in the debate over gender in games is that they design games for men with scantily clad women and et cetera, because women play Facebook games and not MMORPGs, massively multiplayer online roleplay games, or Call of Duty or PS4 games. What do you say to that?
Women play all games. And what's really interesting is that we see genres growing, the number of women growing in all genres across the board. While, you know, more women obviously play on smartphone, and that's something that really kind of women said, okay, I can play on smartphone. You know, this is a new platform. I'm welcome here. The reason that we haven't seen that on console is actually because of marketing trends that happened in the 80s. So we're seeing women, they do play all games, and we're seeing that number growing.
I wonder what you make of that, Kate, because I am a gamer. I have played games for a very long time, and MMORPGs, which are massively multiplayer online role-playing games, like World of Warcraft. But, you know, I play Heroes of the Storm and other games with my son. And when I think about why women aren't on many more of those games, for me personally, not backed by data, it's because I have to put up with a lot of misogyny and you know, other women characters who are not dressed all that thoroughly. Why, Kate, do you think women choose certain games over other games?
Well, I think there's a lot of factors that go into it. I mean, obviously personal preference, but you know, there is a misnomer that a lot of people assume, like, women won't play first-person shooter games, which is completely untrue. I mean, many, many women I know play first-person shooters, and they love them, and they're very, very good at them. I myself love Halo. I worked on some of the Halo games, and I'm still obsessed with the game. It's one of my favorites. But a lot of times what it comes down to is the toxic communities that you find when you are playing some of these games. I mean, obviously, if you're playing a solo campaign, that's not really an issue. But if you want to partake in the multiplayer experience, you often have to deal with communities that are pretty toxic against women. I mean, as soon as you speak up on your microphone and they can tell that you're a woman, you often get all kinds of comments back at you that are pretty derogatory or just outright offensive. So a lot of women I know, they'll say, you know, I play these games, but I keep my mic off. I even know some who change their gamer tag or they change their online name to make it not so overtly female so that they don't get harassed because of it.
Let me play this comment from Nina Freeman. She is a level designer at Fulbright Games. And she also is a gamer and wouldn't think of doing anything else, but she echoes what you've just said, Kate.
I think sometimes it can seem overwhelmingly, like, scary to get involved as a woman in games because, like, bad things can happen. There's, like, sexism and, like, horrible challenges. But, like, it's still worth it, and you can still do it. Like, it's not all bad, you know, because, like, people are willing to speak out about this stuff. It helps make it a better environment. So, like I said, it's all about that balance of acknowledging the issues while also promoting work by people who are marginalized.
So, Leah, where do you see your game, this one in particular, PrinceNapped, fitting into this, I guess, safe spaces for women? Do you see it as a safe space?
I definitely see it as a safe space because you're working with a female bounty hunter's character. So you yourself are the hero of the game. And there's no way that anyone can attack you on it because it's, you know, it's a game where you solve puzzles. It's a mobile game. So it's a very safe space, and it's humorous, and it's fun, and it's challenging.
So you're not interacting with other players, which is often the problem.
No, you're not interacting with other players. You can see your friend's scores, but there's not any, like, communication through talking.
So this, I want to play this other comment, Molly, from Nina Freeman, because it just resonated with me. She's talking about the fact that she's really tired of talking about this.
I actually feel like I end up having to do, like, more interviews about being a woman in games, and, like, when I'm trying to, like, get people to play my games, usually they just want to ask me about what it's like to be a woman in games. My gender is always going to be a part of it because that's who I am, but, like, that is actually one of the biggest challenges, is, like, kind of changing the conversation to be like, it's not only about my gender, like, we can also, like, talk about my work critically.
And I wonder how you feel about that.
It's funny because we got interviewed by Refinery29 the other day, and that was the first interview I've had in 4 years where it was just asked about. I was just asked about design, like, as my work as a level designer. I built every level in the game. Nobody asks about it. And she was like, yeah, I want to know how you built this thing. And I was like, really? You actually do? And that was incredible. And it was after 4 years. I mean, I've done tons of talks and writing, and I know our company, you know, our message is empower women as players. So we bring,
right.
we get a little bit of that as part of our mission. But the fact that no one ever asked about it was crazy to me.
Kate, do you get asked about just game design and not women in games?
No, not really. And part of it is because my function in the game industry, doing this culturalization work I've done for so long, focuses on a lot of these issues. I mean, purposely working with developers, helping them to avoid using stereotypes and of all kinds and a lot of other sensitive political and cultural issues. Because I've been in a more overt advocacy role over the last several years, I tend to get asked these questions point blank and bluntly because they know that I'm there to speak out about them, and I still am very vocal about these issues. So, but I do get occasionally, like I will get people who ask me like, hey, we'd love to have you come to an event and speak about your work, speak about culturalization. You don't need to talk about diversity. You don't need to talk about being a woman in games. You can just talk about what you do. And that's always the best case scenario because nobody really wants to be called out for something that they can't control about themselves. We'd rather be called out for the skills that we have and the experience that we have. And so hopefully we're going to see more of that as a trend over time.
So, Leah, let me give both you and Molly the opportunity to talk about the game itself and, you know, how this game works as just an adventure game, right? I mean, it's called Princenapped, so I have to assume that, like Mario, it begins with the kidnapping of a member of the royalty.
Yes, actually, the princess. We did some little comics. They're not used in the game, but he gets kidnapped while taking bathroom selfies because he's very self-absorbed, and that's just his like personality type. But you're working with bounty hunters to try to save him, and it's through the animations. It's very humorous. Like he's very annoyed, and he wants to just get out. And the bounty huntress is just trying to do her job, and it's pretty cute.
Molly, do you want to add on to that?
Yeah, we started from the perspective of looking at the puzzle genre and trying to see, you know, what all is out there. There's a lot of clones. There's a lot of match three. So we really wanted to innovate in that genre from a mechanic side. And then from the story side, we talked about, you know, what is a prince like usually in Disney movies and all these different kind of movies? And how do we embody the humor that we see in movies that we love? And then how do we treat the woman as someone who we can relate to? So for her, it was all about, she has confidence, but she's kind of getting interrupted by this thing that she's just got to go do. And yeah, then Leah worked that into the animation.
And what is she wearing?
She's wearing armor.
It's armor, yeah.
Real armor that actually covers.
Yeah,
I mean, she's a little feminine.
But she
has like, she's not like overly feminine, especially in her facial features. The loosely based her off of a character named Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica is just very like no nonsense.
Oh, I remember Starbuck.
Girl, yeah, well.
And smart Alec.
You smart Alec, but it has a sense of humor, and that's kind of what I wanted to interpret in the character, especially through her animations, stuff like that.
All right, so Kate, let me play you this clip from one of the games that's always often pointed to as having a strong female lead. It's getting another live action rendition. This is Tomb Raider 3, which featured the iconic Lara Croft.
I have the access, the knowledge, the artifacts.
Yes, but you bumped into me in India and sent me to find them for you, bringing me here. Listen to this gibberish. Your perception of good timing is bad.
So, Kate, where do we put things like Lara Croft? And I say that because in some ways for women in gaming, she's a little bit problematic. She is strong. She is smart. She is a female lead. But at the same time, that comes with someone who's wearing Daisy Duke shorts and a tank top.
Well, one of the things I love about Lara Croft, and for full disclosure, I worked on Rise of the Tomb Raider, which was the latest Tomb Raider game that came out. So I did quite a bit of work on that. And I really love the fact, and I use Laura as an example in the talks that I give to show that they've taken this character who used to be the poster child of sexism in games with her overpronounced features and the Daisy Dukes and everything else, and now she's become a great example of a woman in games who's fully realized. She looks realistic now, but more than just her look, she has a realistic range of emotions and the things she thinks about and the way she approaches problems. You know, and a lot of that I do credit directly to the great writing of Rihanna Pratchett, who worked on the Tomb Raider reboots, and she really brought that character to life in a big way. And of course, now they've got the movie reboot that looks pretty much exactly like the rebooted games.
Yeah, she's wearing pants. Pants. Yay for pants.
It's interesting, you even contrast the movie version. The movie version that's coming out contrasts that with the look of Angelina Jolie's version, which is pretty much copying the video game version. And so I see Lara as a really good sign. It's a good evolution of that character, and it's a good evolution of where we're heading in terms of representation of women in games.
All right, so then let's talk about another new game. This one has been pointed to as well as having a strong female lead. This is from a really popular game called The Last of Us. And the lead was a teenage girl who was fighting through a zombie apocalypse.
No, don't tell me it's busted.
It's busted.
Man, for a second I thought I was going to play it.
You still can.
How?
All right, come here. Close your eyes. Do it.
Okay.
Use this to move. This is your punch, this is your kick, and you block with this.
So, Molly, what do you think of as a successful female lead? Does she need to be noticeably female, or should it just sort of the gender sort of like fade into the background?
Well, see, there's two ends of the spectrum, right? Like, if you make her noticeably female, she talks about her role as a woman and her identity, then you identify with some people who are looking for that. They're looking for a character that says, I represent women, I'm here to represent women. But from other ends of the spectrum, sometimes you want gender to fade into the background because you want her to feel more real and authentic as a character and as a person who doesn't talk about their gender all the time and it's not a thing. So I think there's room for both types of characters. There's characters that, just like there's room for both types of people, people that go out in the world and speak about gender identity and what that means to them, and people who exist and are just strong people in the world who build creative things, right? Like, I don't think all women who work in games need to talk about being women in games, but I'm okay with filling that role sometimes. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And Leah, let me ask you how much progress you think we've made. You know, I like, one of the games I like to play is the South Park games. And the first one, The Stick of Truth, you had no option but to play a male character. Right. And they turned that into a joke for the second one, where you could choose to be a female and all the characters say, wait, you were a girl the whole time, right? And I wonder if we are seeing these signs of movement when it comes to the gaming industry.
For sure. I think we are seeing progress, and we've got more female voices, women voices in the industry and through players. So I definitely think there is progress being made. And you can see that in even the big studios. You know, they're like with Lara Croft, she's evolving. She's turning into something that's strong and empowering. And I think that's great.
And so, Kate, what, I mean, we still can't get away from the statistics. I mean, we have a fraction of people who design games and build games are women. The vast majority of marketing money goes to market to men. So what is our next step? What needs to be done?
Well, I think what we're seeing in the industry now, and especially with the art form of games, is that the game development has become democratized to the point where it's almost as easy as going to an art supply store and buying canvas and brushes and paint and going home and just starting painting a picture because you want to do painting as a form of self-expression. Well, the tools to create games, many of them are free now, like Unity and Unreal and some of the others. They have free versions that you can download. There's a lot of education you can get through YouTube and other sources online. Obviously, I don't think that's quite as good as like actually getting an education and learning all the details about a certain field of game development. But people can get started. And we're seeing more and more people do this from all kinds of underrepresented groups. I mean, just yesterday, in fact, I came back from a Sami game jam. It was taking place up in the Arctic Circle in northern Finland, where there was a game jam, which is basically, you put together a game within a few days, and involved the Sami people, the indigenous people up there. And the games involved the themes around the Sami culture. And so it was just a fantastic experience of being able to use games as a form of expression for those people who are grossly underrepresented in any media. And so I think the more we see that happen, the more opportunity is out there. You know, young women and girls who are interested in games, and they're, you know, many or most are to some degree, all they need is that extra little nudge from their parents or teachers or others to say, look, you can actually do this. Yeah. And to me, that's one of the saddest things I often hear when I talk to students is if I talk about game development, and I'll often have, you know, like a young girl or someone come up to me and say, I didn't realize I can do this.
Yeah.
It's like, well, of course you can.
That's Kate Edwards, former executive director for the International Game Developers Association. You also heard Molly Proffitt and Leah Knighton, CEO and CCO, respectively, of Atlanta-based Kerchunk Games. Their latest game is Prince Napped, and it is out now. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, we'll learn more about climate change and how it affects our planet. I'll talk with an expert from the Weather Channel. What questions do you have about climate change? Do you feel like you really understand it? Call us at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. In honor of Women's History Month, Atlanta's Center for Puppetry Arts pays tribute this week to the women of the Jim Henson Company. Fran Brill was the first female puppeteer that Henson hired for Sesame Street, and you might recognize her playing this lovable character.
My name is Zoe, and I'm proud, I'm proud, I'm proud, and what I'm proud about, I'm gonna tell you.
So Fran Brill's role of Zoe was just one of many characters she played on Sesame Street before retiring from that series. She joins me from our Savannah studio. Hi there.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. I heard you say that before, it wasn't until relatively recently that you thought about being the first female puppeteer.
Yes, and in all fairness, there was Jane Henson, who of course worked with Jim from the beginning, and she did do Sesame Street the first season. I hooked up the second season, but I was like the first bona fide hiree, which never even occurred to me. It never even occurred to me that I was sort of one of the guys for the longest time. I don't know. I guess I'm weird. I don't know.
Well, I know, because I keep imagining that first day walking onto the set, and it's all guys. Well, at least underneath the puppets.
Yeah, but you know what? I just didn't think about it. It really didn't hit me. I was lucky enough that they were very kind to me, because they all were very good puppeteers, the core group. And I had never played with a puppet in my life before I got hired. This would never happen today. But I had all the other tools that Jim was looking for in a female puppeteer. And then I learned how to manipulate very quickly, you know, with everybody's help. But they were just super to me. And it was just the greatest thing in the world. I mean, I guess to be the only female amongst this incredible group of hysterically funny, wonderful men.
Well, many people know you for Zoe, but let's hear from another character that you voice, which is Cammy, and that was the first HIV-positive Muppet.
The other children at school don't want to play with me because I'm HIV-positive. They say they don't want to touch me because they think I will make them sick.
Oh, but Cammy, we all know you can't get HIV just by touching someone or by being friends with them.
What do you make of Sesame Street's role in these more difficult conversations?
Well, this clip you played was from Takalani Sesame, which is the African version of Sesame Street. You know, there's like 175 productions of Sesame Street all over the world, and they all cater to a specific social or environmental or educational problem in that world.
Let me play another clip, because it's basically the same topic, which is about the responsibility of handling difficult subjects. And this clip relates to that, and it's from 2009. Sesame Street did a primetime special because of the Great Recession. It was called Families Stand Together, Feeling Secure in Tough Times. And in this particular clip, we're actually hearing you playing the role of Elmo's mom.
Huh.
Why isn't Mommy at work today?
Well, darling, there's something your daddy and I want to talk to you about.
Come on and sit over here, son.
Okay.
Sit down here.
Okay, Daddy.
Right. Now, you see, yesterday I lost my job, and I'm not going to be working, at least for a little while.
Is it because Elmo has too many toys?
Oh, no, baby. None of this is your fault.
It's nobody's fault. This is just something that happens in families sometimes.
So how carefully do you have to tread in with subjects like this when it may be for kids the first time someone's talking directly to them about a subject like AIDS or a family member?
Yeah, that's a great question. All I can tell you is that there is a tremendous amount of research that goes into every script. You get a lot of very smart people together and talented writers, and the script is read over and over and over again before we performers, you know, get to shoot it. We also, Elmo's mom and Elmo's dad and Elmo did another show where they were talking about the military and that, you know, how do children deal with a parent who's, you know, doing service in a country far, far away. We never said what country it was, but Elmo's mom and Elmo were Skyping Elmo's dad.
Oh, well, Elmo sure has, Daddy.
Oh, good. Well, so have I. And I think about you every time I do. But you know what? Pretty soon, we'll be able to say goodnight to the moon together again. I'm coming home real soon.
Really?
That's great! Yeah!
In that case, Elmo's gotta go.
Well, go? Where are you going, son?
You know, it's wonderful. I think it's what makes me the proudest of being a part of this show is that I feel like, well, I did something with my life. It's great that people are affected by this and children grow up feeling safer, perhaps, because subjects that are difficult to talk about are dealt with. Adoption, blended families. I mean, they're dealing with all sorts of heavy-duty stuff.
Let me play one more clip because I wanted to ask whether there's extra pressure for you being connected with Sesame Street. This is Jim Henson. He was inducted into the Television Academy Hall of Fame in 1987, and this is just a little clip of his speech.
Of course, television is already one of the most powerful influences on our culture, but because it is so powerful, there's a great deal of responsibility that goes with that. And I think those of us who make programs, particularly for children, have to be aware of what we're putting out there. And I think this is what is fun for me and why I'm very grateful for this very special honor. So it makes my work, or rather my fun, so gratifying.
He says that's what makes it fun. Is there no, do you not feel extra pressure because of the impression you may be making?
No, not really, because you're just doing a script, you know. You don't even think about who this is for. You're just there, you're doing the script and doing the best you can with your character and whatever. But I love that clip of Jim's you just played, because this is what was so wonderful about him, is that he looked at television as a force for good. You know, not a force for bad or anything. Everything he touched in his life was to make life better because of his compassion for everybody. You know, what can I say? That's Jim right there. But no, I don't. In fact, many times on Sesame Street, something would be very funny, and we didn't want to lose the laugh because it wasn't quote unquote educational enough. We always were there to entertain. Okay, it wasn't a matter of whether we were doing a show for adults or children. You never thought about that ever. You never said, okay, this is Sesame Street, so we're going to perform for children. We were like comedy sketch performers. We just did the sketch. And never once did we even think, oh, this is way over their heads. You know, this the script is what we had, and sometimes we'd fiddle around with it, but we just played it like a Saturday Night Live sketch.
I'm speaking with Fran Brill. She was the first female puppeteer hired by Jim Henson to work on Sesame Street, and she will be at Atlanta's Center for Puppetry Arts this weekend for an event celebrating the women of the Muppets. Do children, I mean, I have to expect that children often assume you're basically Zoe, right, when they hear you talking?
No, I mean, they don't know anything. I think it's so funny when an adult woman, you know, pulls over her three-year-old child and she says, oh, honey, look, this is the lady that does Zoe. And they look at me, and I'm not 3 years old anymore. I haven't been three for a long time. But they look at me, and it's like, what? You know, and then she says, oh, do the voice. So when I do the voice, and I talk like that, they go, oh, my gosh, it's Zoe! You know, so that's, I'm sorry, the mic's probably just
that
blew out
awesome.
Over there.
No, that's awesome.
You know, where I'm also involved in something else right now, which is a documentary that's being released on March 16th called Muppet Guys Talking. I don't know if you've heard of it, but Frank Oz got together a bunch of us oldie-timey people, and we showed this film, premiered it at the South by Southwest Film Festival last March. And the response was overwhelming, and now you too can see this film on the website, MuppetGuysTalking.com.
I assume that since you're involved, guys is non-gender specific.
I am proud to be a guy. I've always said I'm proud to have been one of the guys, that they treated me equally, you know. If they treated me differently or treated me, you know, or looked down on me or whatever, that would be a whole other story. But no, I did say, shouldn't this be called, you know, Muppet Guys and a Gal, you know, just kidding around. And Frank Oz said, oh, Franny, no, we think of you as one of the guys. You know, so I'm proud.
So let's talk about another aspect. Because you were a classic, you still are, but a classically trained actress.
Yes.
And so I tried to imagine what it must have been like to suddenly be working full time as a puppeteer, which must have been quite a transition. But then there is also this added thing.
Elmo's got something that you want. Zoe's got something that Elmo wants. Put both somethings together and share.
I'll take my something that you like. You take your something that I like. Then put both things together and share.
So did you plan
to so sweet.
Sing?
I haven't heard that in 100 years.
I feel like you're exaggerating. But did you expect to be working at a job where you'd have to sing quite as much as you did?
Oh, I was thrilled because I made my Broadway debut in a musical.
Yeah.
No, I love, well, my I will say that what I one of the things I miss most
I should mention
retired,
that musical was Red, White, and Maddox.
That's
yeah.
Right. I miss most recording. Gosh, I love to get into the studio and record these songs. That was so much fun. And I miss the singing and harmonizing and all of that. And you know, back when we first started, Jim and Frank and Jerry and Richard, we all used to get in the same studio and sit on a stool and record together. But, you know, after years and years, that stopped, and everybody would just come in and record, you know, the stuff they have to do with the engineer. So it wasn't quite the same. But in the early days, that was an enormous joy because we just laughed and laughed and laughed and had such a good time. But anyway, I do miss the recording. It's cool. No, I never expected to do any of this. Please. I just tripped and fell into this job. Trust me.
So why do you think Sesame Street has such staying power? I mean, I'm 48. I watch Sesame Street pretty much every day when I got home from school.
Do you still watch it?
I don't. But I did with my son and enjoyed it when
he was
that age.
That's wonderful.
Why does Sesame Street last?
Oh, you know, it's the gold standard. It appeals to adults primarily. I mean, of course, to children. But the fact that it was intended for a caregiver or a parent to sit and watch the show with the child and explain things, that's why we have celebrity guest stars that appear on the show, so that that will, you know, grab the attention of the adult. And it has never, in all these years, tried to talk down to children. It's funny, but there's never a, oh, yes, you know, it's just not, there's nothing babyish about it.
Or mean.
Oh, never mean.
Never makes fun of anybody.
Oh, no. No, and I mean, again, Jim was just part of this team of brilliant people, John Stone, Joan Ganz Cooney, who created Sesame Street. But the Muppets, I can tell you, they are ironic, edgy, but never cruel, never mean. Oh, no. None of us would ever go there. We might, with the puppets not on us or in an outtake, but not never, you know, just to make each other laugh. But no, there's no meanness in the Muppet world. Uh-uh. And I love that, too. You know, I mean, no, there's no bullying. There's no, that doesn't exist. And Sesame Street does deal with bullying. We've had several shows about that. And, you know, it deals with all these topics.
Do you miss Zoe?
Oh, yes.
Yes, I do. In fact, I think I'm fairly annoying, though I don't do it all the time. But once in a while, I'll talk to my husband as one of my people. And he just sort of rolls his eyes. But yes, I miss doing them terribly because I have like 1,000 people inside me. And that was the joy of being a Muppet, in that I would never be able to play all those characters in a lifetime on the stage or in films or TV. But on Sesame Street, I could just pick up a puppet and do whatever crazy voice or person came to mind. I have this Mrs. Crustworthy, who I really, really like to do, who sort of sounds like she's drunk, but actually it's because her dentures are slipping. So I'll do Mrs. Crustworthy around the house sometimes. I mean, it's sad. It's sad. I know it's sad.
It is not. It is objectively not.
No, this has been a joy. That my life has been fabulous, and just to have been part of this world, I consider I'm one lucky chick.
Fran Brill was the first female puppeter hired by Jim Henson for Sesame Street. She will be at Atlanta's Center for Puppetry Arts this Saturday at 7 p.m. It's an event celebrating the women of the Muppets. Fran, it's been an honor. Thank you so much.
Oh, Celeste, likewise. Thank you.
Just a programming note, tomorrow we'll talk with Sonia Manzano. She played Maria on Sesame Street for more than 40 years. And we will hear from Carol Spinney, who you might know as Big Bird. That's our show for today, but we would love to hear from our Sesame Street fans. Who is your favorite Sesame Street character? Mine is definitely Grover, and the book, The Monster at the End of This Book, was my favorite as a kid. So who was yours? You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or find us on Facebook. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.